Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. How do U.S. courts determine whether or not a law is biased? Here's a case to consider. If a town council denies a zoning permit for a group of home for intellectually disabled persons because residents don't want those kinds of people in their neighborhood, the town's decision is motivated by the public's dislike for a particular group. In constitutional law theory, this justification can be described as animus. The modern U.S. Supreme Court has used the idea as a reasoning as to why some policies are discriminatory in nature and therefore unconstitutional. What role could the concept play in the future of American policy and law? Can animus be used as a means as legal protection for marginalized groups? We're speaking with the author of the book, Animus, A Short Introduction to Bias in the Law, with William Ariza. And William, Professor Ariza, welcome to The Source. I should mention that you are the professor, the vice dean and professor at Brooklyn Law School, and welcome to The Source.
That's right, David. Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
And I guess I should also mention that you're a San Antonio native?
That's absolutely right. I was born and raised in San Antonio, lived there for the first 17 years of my life.
Went to Central Catholic?
That's correct.
Go Buttons.
Yes, go Buttons.
All right, sir. Okay, just in case anyone was wondering, hey, is that the same guy? Yeah, that's the same guy. All right, back. So, animus. Now, I'm interested. I really like your book and what you're talking about here, because this is something that's popping up more and more in our legal discussions about what's happening in the courts. And we see this a lot now with the Donald Trump travel ban. And it's been asked whether or not animus was part of the decision to exclude people from certain Muslim majority countries. So how did animus become part of that?
Well, it's interesting that you start with that, because while my book focuses on animus as an equal protection concept, the litigation over the Trump travel ban has talked about animus in the context of the First Amendment's Establishment Clause, which is a ban on government establishing religion or favoring one religion over another, hence obviously the concern about the majority Muslim nations you were referring to. But what's interesting about this is that the concept of animus is really one that extends across a variety of different constitutional law doctrines, not just equal protection law, but as we've seen with the Trump litigation, the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment as well.
So our phone lines are open. If you've got a question or a comment as we talk about animus and the law, the number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Animus particularly became a question when we're talking about marriage equality in the Supreme Court. Can you tell us more?
That's right. So the first of the modern marriage cases, the Windsor case, which struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, was struck down by the Supreme Court explicitly on an animus ground. Essentially, the majority in the Windsor case concluded that there was nothing that could conceivably have been motivating Congress when it enacted DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, except for a desire to subordinate or oppress same-sex couples. Later in the Obergefell case, that's the case that, of course, mandated that same-sex marriage be the law of the land, the court didn't explicitly discuss the animus concept, but if you pick apart their reasoning, you get a sense that that same concern about the equal dignity of same-sex couples sort of has, you know, was absolutely percolating through the opinion. And that concern with the equal dignity of same-sex couples can be expressed in terms of an anti-animus principle.
What role does the greater public good play in trying to define if there's animus in an argument?
Absolutely. So one of the things the book does is to tie this modern idea of animus back to the very foundations of American constitutional law. And as you implied in your question, one of those basic principles of American constitutional law is that government has to act in pursuit of a public interest. Obviously, it's not a requirement that government always succeed. As we know, government very often makes mistakes. But government at least has to try. That is to say, they have to aim at promoting a public interest, as distinguished from the interests of a particular group of people or a particular class of people. So the theory then is that, as you indicated with your original example about the home for developmentally disabled persons, if government acts to burden a group, not for some greater public good reason, but simply because the constituents of that government don't like a particular group of persons, that's the kind of non-public regarding purpose that the doctrine would describe as based in animus.
Anyone can come up with an argument for anything, as you know, since you teach law. And someone could say that, well, it's not the fact that I don't really like these people in this neighborhood, but they're going to bring down my property values. So that amounts to the government taking away from me. And so I oppose this on those grounds.
Yes, absolutely. And you put your finger on one of the most difficult and therefore one of the most important components of the animus idea, which is, how do you actually conclude that a particular government action is grounded in animus? As you said, it's easy to come up with a public regarding reason for almost anything. So, for example, the city, in fact, it was a Texas city, the town of Cleburne, which is near Fort Worth, when the town of Cleburne decided that they didn't want that home for developmentally disabled people in the neighborhood, they gave some very reasonable public regarding sounding reasons, things like concern about population density, concern about traffic, concern about the legal liability for the residents who were going to be inhabiting that home. And so it's easy to cook up public regarding sounding reasons. And by cook up, I don't mean to denigrate it. I mean, there are good reasons for lots of things that government may do, even if those things consequentially harm a particular group. Figuring out what's really going on, figuring out whether, in fact, those public regarding reasons are the real reasons underlying and motivating the government action, or whether they're simply a cover for something more nefarious, again, something we would call animus, that's a real challenge. And one of the things the book does is it tries to create a structure that would guide courts as they seek to determine whether an action is, in fact, grounded in animus or not.
So one of the reasons why I like talking about this animus topic here is because we're looking at the court as if it were a rational body, and it's going to weigh arguments and looking at the facts. You have to bring evidence, and those evidence are considered, and you get an opportunity through cross-examination to sort of shoot it down and say, well, that's not really true. So animus depends upon the court to be rational.
Yes, it depends on the court being rational. It depends on the court being able to sift the evidence and to really unmask motivations, either good motivations that are perfectly reasonable and legitimate. For example, concerns about population density in the given, residential neighborhood, but also to uncover motives that are, in fact, insidious, motivations that in our system are simply not legitimate. For example, a desire simply to burden someone just because of who that group is or who that person is. So it does require courts to be rational. It requires courts to be objective. It requires courts to be as neutral as possible in cases that are often highly fraught. These are often very, emotionally tinged cases, as you can imagine. Same-sex marriage is obviously very emotionally tinged. The Trump travel ban, same thing. So it's a real challenge for courts to apply this doctrine, but it's more and more important because as cultural polarization continues apace in this country, more and more actions, sadly, are going to be based in illegitimate motivations, and courts are going to be asked to step in, and it's going to be their job to figure out what's going on in a given case.
So right now in Texas, we have a discussion about a so-called bathroom bill, and Texas lawmakers are arguing this now, and we'll see if it gets passed and becomes law. But they're saying that you will be required to go to the bathroom of your birth certificate and not according to your gender identity. And they have all this reasoning for that, which is like, well, it's for public safety, it's for privacy, but people are saying, opponents to this legislation are saying this is animus against people who are transgender. So how does a court step in and say what's what?
Well, I think what a court has to do is they have to look at a number of factors. They have to look at the background of the decision. So, for example, you know, is this decision just one of a long series of actions that burden transgender people? They have to look at whether, in fact, there was something procedurally irregular about this, about the decision-making process. Very often, decisions that are ultimately found to be based in animus are either rushed through or they're pushed through some process that's not the normal decision-making process, and that's often a very good indicator that something nefarious is going on. They have to look at the extent of the impact of this law or this decision on the burden group. Is this a decision, for example, that imposes burdens only on this group, or are the burdens distributed more equally throughout society? So it's not like any one of these factors is determinative in and of itself, but as a court sifts through the evidence, considers these factors, they essentially have to weigh all these factors in deciding whether, in fact, what's going on here is a perfectly legitimate good faith attempt to protect the public safety, or whether, in fact, it's something more nefarious.
We're going to take a quick break. Our phone line is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. We're talking about animus, a short introduction about bias in the law. What does it mean, and how is this being used, and why is this becoming more and more important in our legal framework, particularly as we have all these fights for social justice? Give us a call, 210-614-8980. The source continues after this. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. We're speaking with the Vice Dean and Professor at Brooklyn's Law School, author of the book Animus, A Short Introduction to Bias in the Law, Bill Ariza. And Professor Ariza, one thing about the animus argument that I don't like is that it can be easily cheapened. You can say, you just don't like me. And frequently when we have legal arguments, we talk about the power of the state and how sometimes it's being abused. People take that and they run with it and try to use it for other purposes. Like, well, the reason you deleted my post on Facebook is that's a violation of my freedom of speech. You know, are we talking about animus only as the power of the state?
Yes. No, that's a great question. So animus, as you just indicated, has sort of a common sense everyday understanding of the sort you were just describing. It also has a legal understanding or a legal meaning. And untangling those two, they're certainly related, no question about it, but untangling those two is something that, you know, scholars and lawyers and citizens interested in the law need to think about. You know, when we're thinking about whether courts can, in fact, legitimately perform this sort of animus review. So, yes, the concept of animus can, in fact, be abused. Indeed, it can be abused on both sides. You described essentially the complainant's side or the plaintiff's side of how it can be abused. It can also be abused on the other side. There are people who, feel like my beliefs or my completely good faith beliefs are being impugned now with this, you know, idea of animus, and that they're, you know, I'm being tarred with the brush of being a hater, essentially, to use a colloquial term. And so for that reason, a number of legal scholars have not been particularly enthusiastic about the idea of animus, because it leads to this sort of name-calling that, on this theory, leads to further denigration of the discourse, of the dialogue, and indeed involves courts in that denigration. And so I completely understand that. Having said that, there is something so fundamental when you think about it, about the concept of animus as a legal idea, that I think it's quite worthwhile, it's worth salvaging, and, you know, doing the hard work of coming up with a reasonable, you know, workable doctrine that courts can, in fact, apply. That's, I think, very important work to do. That's really why I wrote the book.
Back to this defense of marriage and how we got at marriage equality. And We saw that eventually many of the arguments that were put forth for the defense of marriage only between a man and a woman were kind of knocked down. The fig leaf was eventually stripped away. And people were saying, this cheapens marriage between a man and a woman, or marriage is for procreation, all these other reasons. And the courts couldn't really find that. And so they said, well, then obviously your argument is only because of you have an ick factor. You don't like same-sex marriage. Is that what happened?
Yes, well, that's largely what happened, although I would add one more point to it. So, yes, the states defending their same-sex marriage bans offered a number of public policy reasons for that exclusion. Things, as you said, things like marriage is all about procreation because same-sex couples cannot procreate naturally. There's no reason to include them within the marriage rite. And as you noted, the court essentially found those explanations unconvincing for lots of reasons. Just to give you one, if marriage was really all about procreation, then why, query, were old people who were beyond procreating age, why were they allowed to marry? Why were people who were simply physically, biologically not able to conceive, why were they allowed to marry? So the courts got rid of those public policy sounding reasons as simply not a good enough fit with the ban on same-sex marriage. But then Justice Kennedy, in his opinion in Obergefell for the court majority, but then he noted that, let's be clear, a lot of people have deep-seated, completely honorable religious views or moral views about what marriage is or what marriage ought to be understood as, in this case, as between a man and a woman. And Justice Kennedy did his very best to honor those views while still recognizing that it was not a point of the government to take sides on what moral views were in fact correct, to instantiate particular religious views into our legal regime. So he had to walk a tightrope between acknowledging the legitimacy of those religious and moral views about same-sex marriage, while at the same time concluding those views, as honorable as they might be, simply had no place underlying an exclusion of the sort represented by the same-sex marriage bans.
Right. So it was the exclusion. It was the establishment of the Defense of Marriage Act that became the issue. That was put in place by the government to protect man-woman marriage. And so they had to justify the harm that it was doing to other populations, same-sex marriage. So it was up to them to defend it, right? And they had to explain why it needed to be there.
Oh, yes. No, absolutely. Whenever there is a government action that imposes significant burdens on people, there is some, in this case, significant discrimination against a group of people, there is some obligation on the part of government to defend itself, to explain itself, to justify itself. Now, how severe that explanatory burden is really a matter of great dispute among courts and among legal scholars, but at the very minimum, there is some requirement of some justification. And frankly, what lower courts had found before the Obergefell case and what the Supreme Court found in Obergefell itself is that these public regarding reasons simply didn't hold water. Judge Richard Posner from the Seventh Circuit, no one's idea of a liberal, in fact, he's quite a libertarian, really just ridiculed the state's arguments for the same-sex marriage bans that were challenged in his court. And that same sort of, not exactly ridicule, but refusal to understand those arguments as even being serious, that permeated the Supreme Court's opinion as well.
We're speaking with Bill Ariza. He's the author of the book Animus, A Short Introduction to Bias in the Law. And the number to call in if you've got a question or comment, 210-614-8980. Isabel is on the line. Isabel, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes. Good afternoon.
Can
you hear me?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, you're fine.
Yes. I was wondering, what is the how does the professor relate or justify that principle he is discussing with natural law based on on Plato, Socrates, and the Aristotelian methods of explaining reality. And it really sounds like a waiting for Godot discussion at this point.
Okay, Isabel, thank you for the call. And so, Professor Ariza, can you help us?
Sure. So it's a really interesting question, which in a lot of ways goes to the foundation of what Americans think our Constitution is all about, the foundation, you know, what Americans think the foundation of their constitutional law is. Certainly one argument is that there is a natural law foundation to American law. And that's, of course, the point of view that was being expanded by your caller. That's not a view that is that easily resonates or easily fits with a lot of American constitutional law, though. A lot of American constitutional law requires that government action be justified by some quantifiable, objective public good, as opposed to, you know, as opposed to natural law goods, which are highly contested, which are matters of philosophical debate and really interesting philosophical debate, but that really don't serve as a legitimate foundation for government action, especially once we get into the 20th and 21st centuries, when American society has become as absolutely diverse as it has. The idea that one culture's conception of natural law can furnish the foundation for a constitutional law for everyone, for every American, that becomes, I think, a lot harder for a lot of justices to accept.
Justice Kennedy has been at the forefront of carving out what is animus and its role in the courts. What happens when he goes away? Will animus lose that its weight?
Well, that's a really fascinating question. And, of course, it's been, you know, it's come to the fore with the recent speculation that the upcoming term might be his last one. So as a matter of pure vote counting, there are four justices on the court, not counting Justice Kennedy, who would probably be perfectly happy to rule in favor, for example, of same-sex couples or other groups who bring equality claims, without relying on animus. In other words, for those four justices, there are probably a number of legal avenues that would get them to the result that they would likely vote for. The reason, in fact, that we have a lot of modern animus cases is because Justice Kennedy has been at the dead center of the court. He's been the fifth vote. And he is really, as your question implies, he's really largely been responsible for the recent development of animus doctrine. What happens afterward, after he leaves the scene, is a fascinating question. Now there's animus precedent on the books, and so a future court majority might be willing to continue with the animus idea. Depending on the nature and the predilections of that fifth justice, the replacement for Justice Kennedy, they might go in different directions as well, though. We're really quite at an inflection point, especially once Justice Kennedy leaves the court, and we have to see what comes after.
Bill Ariza is the author of the book, Animus, A Short Introduction to Bias in the Law, and he is the Vice Dean and Professor at Brooklyn Law School. And thank you so much for joining us. It was great to have you here and you're back on your hometown for On the Air.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much, David.
All right, Animus, and we'll be hearing more about that as these cases come to light and more of them as our population becomes, or our society becomes more pluralized. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for tuning us in.